Thank you again, Mr. Hummel, and good afternoon, everyone. Over the past couple of weeks, I guess it's been a couple weeks since I've spoken. I had a week off, and then we were down in Terre Haute, so it's been a couple weeks up here. But Jude chapter 1, we've been talking about the three individuals who are directly called out. We'll say in verse 11, if you want to go ahead and turn there, we'll start there again. So far, we have looked at the way of Cain, we've looked at the error of Balaam, and today we want to look at that third individual who is mentioned in Jude 11. Because the attributes of these individuals are very alive and well in humanity, and I think that there's a very good reason that they're recorded here as a warning for what we ought to avoid and what we need to be mindful of. Jude chapter, well, that's only verse 3, we'll start there. It says, "Beloved, while I was very diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith which was once for all delivered to the saints. For certain men have crept in unnoticed, who long ago were marked out for this condemnation, ungodly men, who turned the grace of our God into lewd and our Lord Jesus Christ. But I want to remind you, though you once knew this, that the Lord, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe, and the angels who did not keep their proper domain but left their own abode, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day. As Sodom and Gomorrah, to these, having given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire." So Jude brings this out as a reminder, because he's telling the people he's writing this letter to, he's saying, there are people who have crept in, and they're behaving in unsavory ways, and that doesn't go unnoticed by God. If you've ever been in a situation in life where you feel like something's going unnoticed, you're getting the short end of the stick, something isn't right, God notices. Now, it can be hard for us, humanly speaking, to be like, oh, well, okay, God notices, that'll be all right. But we can very often develop attitudes, or we can very often respond in ways that are less than Christian, because it just keeps happening. How did they get here? And so it's good of Jude to remind his audience that, you know what, God takes care of it. Verse 8, he says, "Likewise also these dreamers," the individuals who have crept in unnoticed, "these dreamers defile the flesh, reject authority, and speak evil of dignitaries. Yet Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil, when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, 'The Lord rebuke you.'" So he's talking about how we are to respond to individuals like this. Verse 10, "But these speak evil of whatever they do not know, and whatever they know naturally, like brute beasts, and these things they corrupt themselves." So anything that there's a lot of stuff they don't know, but what they do know, they even corrupt that. "Woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah." And so talking about these individuals and the attributes of them, we can get a little bit more as we go on. It talks about them being clouds without water, talking about them being autumn trees without fruit. That's in verse 12. And so you can see that they're just not producing what they ought to be producing. And yet they are, as it said in verse 4, they have crept in unnoticed. And this is not to be a witch hunt for anything other than us looking at ourselves and considering, do we have the attributes of these individuals in us? As we've been going over this here prior to Passover, just to consider whether or not there are things about us, you and me, that we have that fall into this category. These categories of the way of Cain, the error of Balaam, and the rebellion of Korah. So today we are going to look at the rebellion of Korah. Let's start off with that by going back to Numbers 16. Numbers chapter 16, where we will see just exactly what Korah did. You have to be some kind of individual to have a warning signpost put up about you in Scripture. But in keeping almost with the first message that we heard, there are also many individuals who have put up as signposts for the right things. And it's a wonderful thing to have that. Numbers chapter 16, verse 1, It's not a really long chapter, so we're going to go ahead and just read this. It's kind of broken up into four sections. First three verses, Korah and his band of men come and confront Moses. From 4 through 17, we'll see Moses respond to those allegations. Then from 18 to 40, we see God's judgment against the individuals. And verses 41 through 50, we'll see God's further judgment against individuals who commiserated, I guess, with Korah. So let's look at this, chapter 16, verse 1 of Numbers. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the sons of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men, and they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. That also carries through. You think about David. Whenever I think of men of renown, I think of David and the men of renown, and they went out and they had many conquests. Well, these are individuals of great import and reputation. They are men of renown. They gathered together, verse 3, against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" So when Moses heard it, he fell on his face. And he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, "Tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will cause him to come near to him. That one whom he chooses, he will cause to come near to him. Do this. Take censers, Korah and all your company, put fire in them and put incense in them before the Lord tomorrow, and it shall be that the man whom the Lord chooses is the holy one. And it shall be that the man whom the Lord chooses is the holy one. You take too much upon yourselves, you sons of Levi." And Moses said to Korah, "Hear now, you sons of Levi, is it a small thing to you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the work of the tabernacle of the Lord and to stand before the congregation to serve them? And that he has brought you near to himself, you and all your brethren, the sons of Levi with you? And are you seeking the priesthood also? Therefore you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord, and what is Aaron that you complain against him?" So here we see Moses respond to Korah. And we'll pull out a little bit more about that later on. But then he goes and we see him, verse 12, he sends and calls for Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. These were the Reubenites who came. And they said, "We will not come up. Is it a small thing that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, that you should keep acting like a prince over us? Moreover, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up." And so they refused to come and see him. So he talked to Korah and the company of individuals who were with him, but Eliab and Abiram and Dathan refused to see him. Verse 15, then Moses was very angry and said to the Lord, "Do not respect their offering. I have not taken one donkey from them, nor have I hurt one of them." And Moses said to Korah, "Tomorrow you and all your company be present before the Lord, you and they, as well as Aaron. Let each take his censer and put incense in it, and each of you bring his censer before the Lord, 250 censers, both you and Aaron, each with his censer." So every man took his censer, put fire in it, laid incense on it, and stood at the door of the tabernacle of meeting with Moses and Aaron. And Korah gathered all the congregation against them at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." And they fell on their faces and said, "O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with all the congregation?" This is Moses and Aaron responding to God. So the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the congregation, saying, get away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram." Then Moses rose and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, "Depart now from the tents of these wicked men. Touch nothing of theirs, lest you be consumed in all their sins." So they got away from the tent, from around the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the door of their tents with their wives, their sons, and their little children. And Moses said, "By this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, for I have not done them of my own will. If these men die naturally like the Lord, and consume the 250 men who were offering incense." Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Tell Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, to pick up the censers out of the blaze, for they are holy, and scatter the fire some distance away. The censers of these men who sinned against their own souls, let them be made into hammered plates as a covering for the altar, because they presented them before the Lord. They are signs of the children of Israel." So Eleazar the priest took the bronze censers, which those who were burned up had presented, and they were hammered out as a covering on the altar, to be a memorial to the children of Israel, that no outsider who is not a descendant of Aaron should come near to offer incense before the Lord, that he might not become like Korah and his companions, just as the Lord had said to him. Respond to what Korah, Dathan, and Abiram did in a pretty dramatic way, exactly as Moses said. It's kind of makes me think of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Well, let's kind of have a duel here. Let's see who's right. Let's see who God is listening to. And God, verse 41, you think people would get it, but they don't quite. On the next day, all the congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You have killed the people of the Lord." Now it happened when the congregation had gathered against Moses and Aaron that they turned toward the tabernacle of meeting, and suddenly the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared after Moses and Aaron. They didn't accept, which, I don't know, that's some kind of perspective, that the day after you run away from the ground opening, where God very clearly shows who is his and who is not, that you go and speak against the individuals who are his. But they are coming against Moses and Aaron in verse 42, and Moses and Aaron, verse 43, came before the tabernacle of meeting. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Get away from among the congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." And they fell on their faces. The same response that they had when Korah, Dathan, and Abiram leveled accusations against them. So Moses said to Aaron, "Take a censer and put fire in it from the altar, put incense on it, and take it quickly to the congregation, and make atonement for them, for wrath has gone out from the Lord, the plague has begun." Then Aaron took it, as Moses commanded, and ran into the midst of the assembly, and already the plague had begun among the people. So he put in the incense and made atonement for the people. And he stood before the dead and the living, so the plague was stopped. Now those who died in the plague were 14,700, besides those who died in the Korah incident. So Aaron returned to Moses at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, for the plague had stopped. So this kind of concludes what we know about Korah and the rebellion of Korah. We see those who died not only in the incident, those who were maybe more closely knit to the insurrection, right? Those Korah, those who were in his tent, as well as those who were the tents and the families of Dathan and Abiram. Incidentally, Korah, not his sons, not his children, they did not die. You can reference Numbers 26, verses 9 through 11. You'll see that Korah died, his tent, but you also see the very distinct difference there, where Dathan and Abiram and their sons and children came out to the tent, and all of their tents were swallowed up. It's interesting when you consider this, because you got 14,950 people died that day, well, over those 2 days. To drive home a point that God is trying to make. And we're warned of this in Jude chapter 1, verse 11, to avoid those who are going, those who have a mentality there, like those who perished in the rebellion of Korah. So what is the rebellion of Korah, and how can we avoid it? And that's what we're going to be talking about today. What is the rebellion of Korah? If you had to put down there, I think there are a number of messages you may have heard over the years, talking about rebellion, talking about respect of authority, talking about speaking towards God's anointed. What is the rebellion of Korah? Is it referring to pride, position, self-importance? Yes and no. Is it referring to questioning authority and God's anointed? Again, yes and no. There are two interesting, there's a separate accusation here when we get back into what actually happened here in Numbers chapter 16. But let's turn over to Numbers chapter 2, just to get a little bit of background. Because we have Korah. Now, Korah was a Levite, and you see Moses addressed them. He says, "You take too much on yourself, sons of Levi," because Korah was a Kohathite, was part of the tribe of Levi. And As a Kohathite, if you were to go and look at how the layout of the tabernacle in the wilderness and the Israelites were placed out, they were on the south side of the tabernacle. And there, I believe there were around 8,600 of them, of the men, they're on the south side of the tabernacle. And because there are 12 tribes, and they're actually on all four quadrants, and then on the inner portion around the kind of the tabernacle of meeting there in the wilderness, there are Levites around them. I believe Moses and Aaron and the priests were on the east side. The Kohathites were on the south side. And then there's a one starts with an M and one starts with a G, and I can't remember them right now. The other
Merari and Gershom.
Gershom and Merari were the other two components of the tribe of Levi, and they are around on the other sides. But for us, as we're looking at this, Korah, the Kohathites, they're on the south. Incidentally, so too is the army of Reuben. Reuben was actually would have been on for you like the farthest southeast, and so they're there just south of the Kohathites. Also to consider with this, we're Numbers 2, chapter 10. We'll see. It says on the south side, Numbers chapter 2, verse 10. We're talking about where the individuals, the tribes, and the armies are on the south side of the tabernacle shall be the standard of the forces. With Reuben, according to their armies, and the leader of the children of Reuben shall be Elizur, the son of Shedur. And his number was 46,500. And you see camp next to him is Simeon. Camp next to him is Gad. And so you keep going around and you'll see the distinction. There are going to be three tribes each side as they go around the perimeter of the tabernacle. So Reuben is on the south. And let's go to chapter 3. Verse 27 of Numbers, chapter 3, verse 27. This is talking about the sons of Aaron, the Levites, and their service and where they are. It says, from Kohath came the family of the Amramites, and the family of the Izharites, and the family of the Hebronites, and the family of the Uzalites. These were the families of the Kohathites. According to the number of all the males from a month old and over, there were 8,600 keeping charge of the sanctuary. The families of the children of Kohath were to camp on the south side of the tabernacle. So they too are on the south side of the tabernacle in close proximity to those in Reuben. And the kind of attitudes being brought forth, the accusations being leveled, is a Levite. I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's go to 4 verse 4 because this is going to add even more to it. More juice to the story, if you could say. Numbers chapter 4, verse 4. This is what the sons of Kohath were to do. This is the family that Korah is from. Those are the Kohathites. Numbers chapter 4, verse 4 says, this is a service of the sons of Kohath in the tabernacle of meeting relating to the most holy things. They were all given specific duties. Some were given the duties to pack up the exterior of it. Some were given the duties to, as the Kohathites were, to pack up the things that were most holy. So they went in and they made sure that all of those bronze censers, all of the various things that were commemorated to the temple to be used in the services, they had to, whenever they picked up and moved, this is what they dealt with. Okay? Verse 5, when the camp prepares the journey, Aaron and his sons shall come, and they shall take down the covering veil and cover the Ark of the Testimony with it. So only the priests could do that. They were there. They took the veil. Looking down the road in the future, this is the same one that was rent from top to bottom, right? They would take the veil down. They would cover the Ark of the Testimony with it. Then they shall put it on a covering of badger skins and spread over that a cloth entirely of blue, and they shall insert in its poles. On the table of showbread, they shall spread a blue cloth and put on it the dishes, the pans, the bowls, the pitchers for pouring, and the showbread shall be on it. So after Aaron and his sons came in and did that, then this is what the Kohathites were to handle. And it just goes through and tells exactly how they were to care for these most holy things. So Korah and the Kohathites, their job was, right next to being the priest, essentially, extemporaneously, right? But you can see the mentality and the mindset. Now tack on to this, you now have Reuben in close proximity to Korah and his band of men. What was Reuben? Reuben was the firstborn. And Reuben lost out to Judah because, Reuben made bad decisions and poor decisions. You have consequences for every decision that you... Reuben is there as, really the real head of the tribe, right? Even though the scepter went over to Judah because of how he conducted himself, right? But you have Reuben who's saying, well, you now have an accusation against not only the spiritual authority and the role of the, but you have an accusation against the, the civil component of things, right? Who is in charge of it? Of the nation itself, and who is the leader there. And so that's where you have Dathan and Abiram. And they're like, you're leading these people around Moses. Willy-nilly, we're going everywhere. We're not going to where you said we were going to talk to you. You should be coming to talk to us. And the next time Moses came and talked to them, they die in their camp. But so when we look at these individuals who came up and are leveling the accusations against Moses and Aaron, and Moses' response to them, and this is to distant past, had done the same thing to Moses. The same thing. And Miriam was leprous, right? It's like, really? We're doing this again? But you see him respond in a very humble way. So considering here what Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, their background, who they are, what they're kind of doing, where they are in life, and how they're coming at Moses and Aaron. Let's now look at some other scriptures as we kind of try to answer what is the rebellion of Korah. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12. If you want to keep your spot here in Numbers, that's probably a good thing to do. We'll be back to Numbers 16 quite a few more times. Saying that probably more for myself. Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12. We see this mindset is not new. Because as Solomon wrote, there is nothing new under the sun. It is there. This mindset is consistent. Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12. This is speaking of the fall of Lucifer. It says, how you have fallen, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you are cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation, on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. He had great aspirations. He had plans for himself. God, you take too much on yourself. I don't think you really realize what it means to deal with, you know, these people, this creation. He wanted something bigger. And it sounds, again, very similar to what Korah, Dathan, and Abiram said. Oh, Moses, Aaron, you take too much on yourself. I want to have that spot. I would like to have that. Ezekiel chapter 28. Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 11. We'll read verses 11 through 19. Is here another section of scripture relating to Lucifer. It is the duality here. Exodus chapter 28, verse 11. This is a lamentation for the king of Tyre. It says, moreover, the word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre and say to him, thus says the Lord God. You were the seal of perfection. Full of wisdom and perfect in beauty, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering. The sardis, topaz, and diamond, beryl, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day that you were created. You were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you. Do you see a parallel here between what the responsibilities of the Kohathites was and what we're reading here in Ezekiel? It's very, I mean, the overlap is immense. Verse 16, by the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence. Violence within, and you sinned. Therefore I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I laid you before kings that they might gaze at you. You defiled your sanctuaries by the multitude of your iniquities, by the iniquity of your trading. Therefore I brought fire from your midst. It devoured you, and I turned you to ashes upon the earth. In the sight of all who saw you, all who knew you among the peoples are astonished at you. You have become a horror and shall be no more forever. Now let's take that in concert with Revelation chapter 12, verse 4. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 4. Here we are talking about Lucifer, became Satan, had been an angel of light, covering cherub. And we see that he had a desire for something bigger, higher, more. We see that he went about, he ends up getting cast down. He has a multitude of iniquity. He's merchandising, he's trading, he's interfacing. And here in verse 4 of chapter 12 in Revelation, we see here that his merchandising and his trading as he went forward resulted in the fact that he drew a third of the stars of heaven, referring to the angels, and threw them to the earth. The dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. And we know that Satan pulled a third of the angels as a result of his merchandising. He had a desire. He starts trading and merchandising, and he ended up affecting a third of the angels. Let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 15. 2 Samuel chapter 15. See here another individual, extremely charismatic. We'll pick it up in verses 1 through 6. Here we have David's son, Absalom. If you'd like the backstory, I'll give you a Cliff Notes version. His sister gets raped. His dad doesn't do anything about it. Let me rephrase that. His dad doesn't do what he wanted his dad to do about it. King David didn't do what Absalom wanted him to do about it. Didn't feel like he had satisfaction. And gets bent out of shape over it. Goes into exile. Comes back after David forgives him. And here's what happens. Verse 1 of chapter 15. After this happened, Absalom provided himself. He'd come back into Jerusalem. He provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. So it was, whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" And he would say, "What?" And he would say, "Your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel." And then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you." Moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were made king in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, then I would give him justice." And so it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. In this manner, Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. We see here another individual who's in a position adjacent to the preeminent power, shall we say, the prominent position, who has a desire and then acts on it, and it ends up, he steals the heart of Israel, David goes on the run, and it's exactly what God told David would happen because of his sin, right? There are consequences. And On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men, and they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. Because the more likes and followers I have, the more right I am. Sound familiar? That I have. This is not anything new. This is how we function. If I don't think that you're going to listen to me, well, then you know what? I am going to have everybody sign this petition, and I'm going to strong-arm you to have to make a move. What did Korah do? Leaders from the tribe of Reuben, you know, the rightful head of the nation, not Judah, I mean Reuben, oldest, right? And he brings them along with 250 representatives to go talk to Moses. Now let's go down to verse 9. Verse 9. Moses talked to, before we get to verse 19, Moses talked to Korah. You see him in verse 5, he speaks to Korah and all his company. So everybody who came, Moses spoke to them. He speaks directly to them. He doesn't go out and publicize this, Dathan, Abiram, 250 leaders, and Moses speaks to them. He's mostly speaking to Korah because he's talking about them as Levites, right? Sons of Levi, this is what you're taking on. Do you realize? Is it a small thing? And he's like, you were a covering cherub. You're working in this capacity. Why are you trying to get something else? He talked to them privately. And in verse 19, then, we see Korah gathered all the congregation against him at the door of the tabernacle. So the next day, when Moses said, go get your censers, fill them with incense, we're going to all meet over here. It wasn't just Korah and the 250 who had the censers. He brings all the congregation against them at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Well, that escalated quickly, right? I just want you to know, Moses, everybody is on my side. We all see it the same way. Incidentally, he forgot that it didn't matter how he saw it. More mattered how God saw it, right? But he gathered all the congregation against them. Let's go down now to verse 41. Even after Korah is gone, what is the effect? Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, all gone. Now you think, well, what was Gamaliel's advice? You remember that guy? So-and-so died, nothing came of it. So-and-so, the leader, you know, if this is of God, you can't stop it. But if it's of man, the leader's gone, nothing's going to happen. But this is an interesting thing, because this is not just a movement. And this gets at the heart of what Korah did. But verse 41 of verse 41 through 50 of Numbers chapter 16 says, on the next day, all the congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron. Now they were expert murmurers. You can go read through the book of Exodus and you will see this is what they do, right? They are good at it. But they come up again on the heels of just watching the leaders be obviously killed at the hand of God. I mean, if I say the ground's going to open, you know, if it's a new thing, you almost feel like you could say anything because God is going to make that happen. Because you know God's on the side of Moses and Aaron, and he was happy. You know, in him saying that, he's also putting himself on the chopping block that if I'm wrong, guess what? The ground's going to open up and get me too. Right? So it's one or the other. People saw this. They didn't listen and get far away enough, because then they all started running, going like, oh no, it's going to get us too. He said, separate yourself from the tent. But the next day, they all come and they're murmuring. They're complaining against him, saying, you've killed the people of the Lord. And the result is that they then get a punishment as well. But what we see here, again, is the effect of Korah on the camp. So what is the rebellion of Korah? What is the issue? You know, if you have somebody who is disgruntled, one disgruntled person in isolation is not a problem. You know, you talk to any teacher who's had one of those fun, prickly kids in the class, right? Figuring out, though, how to keep them isolated to not affect others, therein lies the rub, right? That's the difficult thing, because what Korah did is he poisoned the well. He was discontent with what he wanted. He didn't like where he was. Lucifer didn't like where he was. Absalom didn't like where he was. And so what did they do? They went about sharing that discontent with other people. And if you've ever been in a position where you have been disgruntled about something or discontent about something, you will likely know and remember. If you're thinking about how you respond to it, that is hard to root out once you have it in there. It's hard to look on the bright side, to see all the good things, when you just get rubbed the wrong way about where it is. Someone has wronged you, When that has happened to me, it is just, it's tough. It's tough not to let it consume your mind. So that's the thing that you talk about. Did you realize just how bad it is? I mean, seriously, everything, every word the person says to me, every interaction I have, it's just sour, it's bad. My boss is horrible, the coworkers, I'm just not being recognized. All of these things that occur, and the discontentment. Do we keep that to ourselves? If you do, you're a bigger person than I am. There are weak points where you're like, you have to take the stopper out, and it has to gush somewhere. And you've been so good for so long, and you haven't shared it with anybody. Oh, but then somebody, they're a good friend, and so I'm going to consult with them. And there it goes. It's like the little Dutch boy trying to keep all the plugs in. Because now it spews forth, and it goes. And, you know, maybe they just talk to their spouse about it because it's confidential. Or maybe, and it just slowly, it is no longer just something that has been contained. It is now something that can bring about discontentment in others. Let's go to Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18. Pick up in verse 6. Matthew chapter 18. Matthew 18, verse 6, says, "Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depths of the sea." Well, that's pretty graphic. That's very specific. "Woe to the world because of offenses, for offenses must come, but woe to that man by whom the offense comes." See, the word here, offense, you know, if you're offended about something, that's okay, but this is a poor English translation of the word here. What is more aptly translated is, "Woe to him who puts a," it's like the trigger stick for a snare. When you set a snare, you set a trap, you know, you put the bait out there, and the trigger stick is what they would walk by, brush by, and then, you know, trap goes down, right? They get caught. This is saying, woe to the individual who puts that trigger stick in place, because you don't set a snare unless you know how the habits of an individual, of an animal, right? So you watch for the animal paths, you see where they're going, they constantly go over here. So this, that when you set the snare, you put it in the path where you know they're going to be. Woe to the individual who puts that trigger stick in front. Going on to verse 8. "If your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life lame or maimed, rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into the everlasting fire." Don't let something be that trigger stick that is going to get you caught. It's better to not have it. "And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life with one eye, rather than having two eyes to be cast into hell fire." Why are we reading this section? Because what did Lucifer, Absalom, and Korah all do? They had discontent with where they were. But they were not happy to let it just be their own perspective. 2 Jude 11, just to read it again to look at what it says here. Jude 11, it says, "Woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah." Who perished in the initial discontentment and was willing to be there as the face of the rebellion? It was everyone who was there who got tripped by that trigger stick, who got trapped in the mindset of discontentment and was willing to take that on as a cause du jour for them. That, yes, this is... Woe to those who put his trigger stick before others, and that's exactly what Korah did. And so, I'd submit, it's not just about rebellion. It's not just about pride and position. But it's about someone who's willing to put that stumbling block in front of others for the sake of their own gain. Yeah, I might have a different perspective on it. If I take a few with me, well then, I guess that's the price. Who else has that mindset? What does the devil do? What does the dragon do when he knows he starts going after everyone who might possibly have an out? Everyone who has accepted Jesus Christ as their Savior, believes in the plan of God and is striving to live that way, what happens in the time of the end? He's like, those are the ones I want to go for. This is the called out people of God. We're going to go into the promised land. We're going to get them. Korah didn't go off and say, you know what? I'm discontent. I'm just going to go over here because I recognize that, you know, this is just not my spot. I'll go and I'll do my own thing, you know, for what it's worth. At least Jeroboam made his own section of things, right? Yeah, but that's not the puff up Jeroboam. Listen to Mr. Kiesel's message on what's wrong with Jeroboam. But, you know, when we have this discontentment, our human nature, our proclivity that goes in direct opposition to God is, well, I'm going to take from here all that I can get, and I'm just going to pack it into every pocket, and I'm going to run. And it is, you can see it. Look at the history of the Church of God. This is what we do. We divide up, and it doesn't matter what the collateral is. And that's the issue with Korah. It wasn't necessarily that he just had a bad attitude, but he went through it with such rampant disregard for other people that he was willing to take them down with him. That's the problem with Korah. So how can we avoid this mindset? You might say, well, I'm not a rebel. I don't have to deal with this. I'm not in a position of authority. I don't have to deal with this. Not my problem, right? Check. This is not one of the things I have to look into. Let's go to Luke chapter 22. Luke chapter 22. This always baffles me when I read it in context because it's a story about somebody else. But then when I start thinking about it and internalizing what I read here, I'm like, yeah, I do that. Luke chapter 22, verse 24. Jesus Christ has instituted the Passover symbols. They're having the meal. Luke chapter 22, verse 24. Now, there was also a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. I sat closest to him at dinner. I mean, what is that? I was the first one who he called. He picked me first. I'm the oldest among the group. Who's going to be the greatest? And Christ said to them, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors. But not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he who governs as he who serves. For who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as the one who serves. Remember, he had just broken the bread. He had just passed out the wine. But you are those who have continued with me in my trials. And I bestow upon you a kingdom, just as my Father bestowed one upon me, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. He says, you're going to have a position. God gave me one. You're going to have one. Stop bickering. Stop arguing about who's going to have the... Don't focus on that. That should not be your focus. That's what the Gentiles look after. They want to make sure they're all cared for and taken care of, and you know they want to be the ones who have all of that lined out. Don't worry about that. Matthew chapter 20. Matthew chapter 20. Read the first 16 verses there. This is the parable of the workers in the vineyard. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. Now when he had agreed with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And he said to them, you also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right I will give you. So they went. And again he went out about the sixth and the ninth hour and did likewise. And about the 11th hour he went out and found others standing idle and said to them, why have you been standing here idle all day? And they said, because no one hired us. And he said to them, you also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right you will receive. So when evening had come, and the owner of the vineyard said to his steward, call the laborers and give them their wages, beginning with the last to the first. And when those came who were hired about the 11th hour, they each received a denarius. But when the first came, they supposed that they would receive more, and they likewise received each a denarius. And when they had received it, they complained against the landowner, saying, "These last men have worked only 1 hour, and you made them equal to us, who have borne the burden and the heat of the day." But he answered one of them and said, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what is yours and go your way. I wish to give to this last man the same as to you. Is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with my own things? Or is your eye evil because I am good? So the last will be first and the first last. For many are called, but few chosen." When you consider the stories, the events, the individuals we read, whether it's Lucifer, Absalom, or Korah, that discontentment with what God was giving them is no different than this individual who is working through the heat of the day. But the response of God is like, "It's mine to give. I'm willing to give it. You knew what you were signing up for. I made you to be the covering cherub. Are you not content with that? I set you in place to care for the most holy things. Are you not okay with that? God has called us to a life of sacrifice, of tribulation, of who knows how long of having to be obedient other than from the time we commit to the time we die. It's whatever that length is. Are we content with what He's giving to us? With the difficulties that we endure along the way? With the growth opportunities that we have? Or are we having a little bit of grumbling going on? Are we allowing ourselves to take on a mindset of discontent? And if we do, is that festering to a point that it gets shared with other people? This is not to say don't share your struggles or your difficulties. But this is talking about how we deal with those aspects of life with which we are discontent. Because you can share a struggle, and we can pray for one another. You can lean out, you can reach out and say, you know, there are times that you need to have your arms held up because you can't do it anymore. There are times where, like Jesus with his disciples, his friends, they wouldn't even stay up with him. There are times we need support, and that's right, and that's good that we should be there for each other. But when we have those difficult positions, he didn't say, "Oh," and just start, man, railing on his disciples for not staying up for Peter, James, Peter and John while they were there with him. He didn't start railing against them, having a bad attitude about it, being discontent with what the individuals that God gave him. Man, if he had given me stronger individuals, this would have been easier for me. You know, he didn't start going into that mindset. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 4. "But that he also first descended into the lower parts of the earth. He who descended is also the one who ascended far above all heavens, and that he might fill all things." So we see here a little bit of an inset background as to what he did in order to be able to give us the gift that he gave us. "And he himself gave some to be apostles, pastors, and teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we should no longer be children, tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men and a cunning crafty, but speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things into him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love." How do we avoid the rebellion of Korah? We have to acknowledge the preeminence of God. And if we accept that, if we're willing to accept that, which hopefully we are, because that is a part of what we go through in the process of baptism or repentance, we accept Him as our Lord and our Master, right? But we accept the preeminence of God. Well, okay, what is He doing? Well, I'm going to put you here. You, Moses, are going to lead these people. I don't want to. I'm giving you your brother. Here, go lead these people, right? What if nobody was there? What if Korah, the Kohathites, were not there to pack up the things, the most holy things? Well, then who else would have done it? Well, we're priests now. Sorry, we can't do that. Everything is there, fitly joined. God gave His Spirit and skill so that people could be artisans, so they could be musicians. It is all there. We're not all to be eyeballs or pinky toes or ears. We're here to function in whatever that capacity is. And the only way that we can get through without being disgruntled or discontent is to make sure that we're endeavoring to find that, and also to find that for other people. We want to be looking for that, as was brought out in the first message, to be looking for those ways of giving encouragement, of praise to other people. We are not all good at the same things. I can have a long conversation about the things I'm very bad at doing. There are a couple things that I think I can do moderately well, right? But it's not for us to do all things. There's only one. You know, I know Paul tried. He said that he'd be all things to all people. But there's only one in Jesus Christ and in God the Father who can do all those things. And it's by Him and through Him that we're able to do that. The rebellion of Korah is definitely a way of life filled with pride and self-importance, disrespect, a desire for position, rebellion, so much more. At its core, though, it is a way of life that is embroiled in discontentment and a disregard for the effects of sharing that with other people. What we say, our attitude, and how we conduct ourselves is extremely important. We need to make sure that we're not the disciples arguing prior to Passover about who's the greatest. Instead, we ought to be disciples who are recognizing the gift, the grace that God has given us is unique, is different. We are all going to be different in that way because we all have different skills, challenges, and abilities, and God is going to grow us in those capacities. It's our job now in this life to make sure that we're trying to find those and expand them. Grow those talents so that when He returns, He will say, "Well done, good and faithful servant." So let's make sure here as we are finalizing our preparation to the Passover that we avoid not only the way of Cain, the error of Balaam, but also the rebellion of Korah.